This is February 22nd, 2015, and for Teisho today, I'm going to talk about aspiration and the difference between aspiration and greed, desire. That is desire based on growing out of greed or attachment. This came to me slowly this week and this morning, this topic, because I found myself reflecting on the term intensive reports that have come to me, and that this is the final week of our annual winter term intensive, 5-week term intensive, when people are invited to join others in doing what they can to step up their practice, not just through sitting, but through other forms of self-discipline and extending oneself beyond what one ordinarily does. The idea being, because it's just 5 weeks and not 5 months or 5 years, we can attempt to do more than we have in the past, or maybe even ordinarily could do, just for this limited time period. What strikes me from these reports and from my own efforts every time is this fine line between realistically working to go beyond oneself, beyond the self and its limitations. That's on the one hand, being realistic about it, but still reaching, aspiring. And then on the other hand, being unrealistic, overextending oneself, trying to do too much, and then failing. What is that line? It's a very interesting dynamic that happens there. And really, it's in greater relief during a term intensive than ordinarily, but it's really what the line or the edge that we're always working with in practice. And not just Zen practice or even spiritual practice generally, but in all kinds of ways in which we want to work to develop ourselves. So we have anyone who is working to develop herself, to go beyond the forces of inertia, of laziness, is involved in an aspiration. We aspire to go beyond ourselves. But the danger is when that tips into a unrealistic grasping or craving. It's the difference between the desire to do something, which is absolutely essential in practice, even if it just means becoming more thoroughly one with the breath. That's the desire to do something. And then the other side, the unhealthy part of it, is the desire to become someone, to remake the self, in order to become someone, but still a self. In the Pali language, there are two words for this. The word for aspiration, the aspiration to do something, like the aspiration to come to awakening for the sake of all beings, not just oneself, but for the sake of all beings. This is the word is chanda. And then the other, the unwholesome one, is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which is usually translated as thirsting, craving, we could say grasping. It grows out of the whole idea of becoming. The word becoming is not one that I don't know that I've ever used it in Taisho. It's a rich word that's found much more prominent in the Theravadin school. Zen is part of the Mahayana tradition, and then in the Theravada, there's a lot more said about becoming. It has this unwholesome quality to it because it's seen as arising out of craving, greed to be somebody. And from that comes this perpetuation of the self. I fished out several koans from our curriculum of koans that particularly speak to this. As long as we are caught in grasping, then we are fall prey to attachment. This is dramatized in number 9 in the Mumon Kan, where a monk asked a certain master, Daitsu Chisho Buddha, who appeared in a metaphorical passage of the Lotus Sutra. This koan is the only place I've ever heard of the name Daitsu Chisho Buddha not being steeped in the Lotus Sutra. But a monk asked this master, Daitsu Chisho Buddha, did the Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom, did Zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but could neither manifest the Dharma nor attain Buddhahood? Why was this? And the master said, your question is exactly the point. The monk persisted, why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing Zazen on the Bodhi seat? And the master said, because he didn't attain Buddhahood. So, okay, it's somewhat illogical. How could a Buddha not attain Buddhahood? You know, it's just you get into semantics here. Doesn't Buddha mean that he's attained Buddhahood? But leaving that aside, I think many people, not just people who work on these koans, many people can sort of suss out what the problem is here. That the monk is caught in progress. As long as we are trafficking in thoughts about progress or lack of progress, then we will be impeded in our practice. This is one of the most subtle and pernicious obstructions of the mind, is thoughts about progress. I think most people, at least for the first 5 or 10 or 20 years of practice, most people are not aware of how much they dwell in thoughts of their progress or their lack of progress, or comparing their progress to others or their lack of progress. It goes on unconsciously at first. A broader way to understand this beyond just progress is that a lot of people, when they're doing Zazen, are thinking about their practice. That's not the same as truly practicing. just becoming the breath, just becoming mu, questioning another koan. That just doing the breath of the koan is light years away from thinking about one's practice. And yet this is what foils people so much, is thinking about their practice. I just mention this so that maybe one will start to notice when one is doing this and can then do the real practice, which is just the breath of the koan, and not be thinking about practice. In some of the Chinese Zen texts, you run across masters who say, just don't strive. And many people, I think, could understandably be confused by this. Don't strive? Isn't striving and aspiration, aspiring, the same thing? Well, it could be. I suppose maybe a dictionary of synonyms might link the two. But here is how I understand that, don't strive. It means really this unwholesome grasping after something. This is a big obstacle for many of us. It certainly was for me. Often it's the thought of enlightenment. You set this thought up in your mind and you are grasping for it. That's a sure way of not being able to awaken. In the number 19 of the Mumon Kan, this is taken up by the great Joshu, who asked his teacher Nansen, what is the way? You could say that, what is the Dharma? What is truth? What is reality? What is the Tao? Nansen answered, ordinary mind is the way. Zhaozhou asked, shall I try to seek after it? Or we could say strive after it. And Nanchuan says, if you try to seek after it, you go away from it. And then Zhaozhou says, but if I don't try, how can I realize the way? And then Nanchuan said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Or we could say, the way is not a matter of getting it or not getting it. It's a very delicate distinction here, because no one ever need apologize for having a strong aspiration to awaken to their true nature, because ultimately that is how we become we can best help others, is by seeing the illusory nature of self and other. So that's a wonderful thing, to have that fuel one's practice, that aspiration. But it's so easily, almost invariably, curdles into this wanting to get something. And that's, I think, what holds many of us back for the longest time. Eventually, if we stick with it enough, then practice has the power to dissolve that grasping mind, and that's when things really open up. But it can take a long time, because we're so conditioned to want to get something for the self. I want to become an enlightened person, not just awaken to be a vehicle of service to others. One of the many words of Roshi Kapo that continued from time to time to ring in my ears is when he said, from the point of view of ego, everything is an expression of ego. From the point of view of our true nature, everything is the functioning of our true nature. Let's just break that down. Maybe we can understand in terms of how we understand the word self. Let's just use self instead of ego. We see it there in our desire to come to awakening. It can be and invariably is tainted by this wanting to become someone special, but it's also, at the same time, if you look at it in the other way, it is that very aspiration is the manifestation of our true nature, our enlightened, our inherently enlightened nature. It's both. It's a mix, or even not to even say mix. It just depends on how you're looking at it. As we would say with a coin, you could say a coin is a mix of heads and tails, but another way is if you look at it from one side, it's just tails. It's just the self grasping, this small self grasping to become something special. Or it's just the heads. Even in that wanting to be something special, it's still that itself is not outside the functioning of our true nature. It's just magnificent how everything we do can be seen from either side. And it's the same with our goals that we set in, for example, a term intensive. Or New Year's resolutions. Until full enlightenment, I suppose, until full enlightenment, those resolutions, those aspirations, those goals will to some extent be contaminated by willful striving. And always you can say that with the ego, I'm just saying that instead of to distinguish it from our true self, with the working of the ego, our small s self, there is linked with that is this willpower. There's another exquisite razor's edge where we need some element of willpower to go beyond ourselves, but ultimately we have to get beyond self-will into what is beyond it, the way. Even after awakening, there is still this admixture of the grasping of the self and the transcendent longing or aspiration of our true self. And certainly there are so many ways that this plays out. Habit forces, habit energy. Again, knowing one's life will be enhanced, one's day will be enriched by sitting every day. There's the awareness of that, and yet the holding back, the wanting, preferring to just hit the snooze and roll over in the morning. Or in terms of food, which is another theme you see in the term intensive pledges, knowing what food is nourishing, and knowing that moderation is the key thing, and yet getting caught by our cravings, our attachment to pleasure, knowing that exercise is crucial for not just looking better, but cardiovascular health, muscle tone, and yet again and again and again failing to maintain a regimen that we know that we could. This is the very meat and potatoes of practice. The substance of practice is running again, over and over again, into our limitations. And a mature practice is one in which we don't resign ourselves to our limitations, and we don't deny the fact that any given time we have limitations. Buddhism has often been called the middle way. The middle way, one way to understand it, is the middle way between self-punishment and self-indulgence. But that itself is, in a way, part of a broader way to understand the middle way, and that is between affirming the self and denying the self. The Buddha never said, according to every text I've read, the Buddha never said categorically and simply, there is no self. What he said, in so many words, to paraphrase, is that there is no fixed, permanent self of some kind of enduring substance, unchanging substance. And we can see this, again, this dichotomy play out over and over again. And I, back to mature practice, between accepting that we can't just through our willpower make ourselves Olympic athletes, accepting the limitations of the self, and yet not resigning ourselves to any notion about the limitations of ourself. We don't need to carry around ideas about what we can't do, what we're incapable of. That's just part of our ego. It's trying and failing, and trying again and failing. Working at it. Working this self that is no self. This self that is actually a process. The self is a process. It's a dynamic process, a work. We have to learn to accept our limits without resigning ourselves to them. Our limits, which always mean at any given time, today. Our limits today may not be our limits next week. And there too is such a fine edge of striving, aspiring, without getting caught in success and failure as some self-referential idea. Yeah, we can say that if we if we pledge in a term intensive to do 10 hours of extra sitting a week and we don't make it, yeah, you could say that's a failure, but it doesn't mean I'm a failure. There's no I or me in there to which the notion of failure can stick, or success. There's nobody here. Many of us who come to practice, probably many people in religion broadly, have a tendency to be attached to purity, perfection. And that is an attachment. There are many koans that address this attachment, because it is so common in not just in Zen, but in, I think, all religions. You see it at work with Muslim extremists. You see it at work with Sharia law. This grasping at this realm of purity, of perfection. There's another koan, this one on the Blue Cliff Record, where Zen Master Enkan called to his attendant, "Bring me the rhinoceros horn fan." This is a way of saying, "Show me your realization." The attendant said, "The fan is broken." Enkan said, "If the fan is broken, bring the rhinoceros to me." And the attendant made no reply. And then in this koan, there are several later masters, five of them, who comment on this exchange. "Bring me the rhinoceros horn fan. The fan's broken. If the fan is broken, bring the rhinoceros to me." And one of them, Tosu, a century later, speaking in place of the attendant, said, "I do not refuse to bring it out, but I fear the head and horn will be imperfect." And then Secho, who offers a lot of comments in this collection of koans, Secho commented saying, "I want that imperfect one." I want that imperfect one. Sooner or later, we have to rid ourselves of notions of perfection and becoming perfect, or we will be forever suffering. It's a notion. Perfection is a notion. It's an abstraction. There is nothing and no one that is perfect, as we usually think of the word perfect. We have to make peace with that. We have to make peace with failing over and over in what we try to do. And yet never stop trying. Zen Master Dogen, I think, said, "No creature ever comes short of its completeness." It's perfection. It's a wonderful, wonderful song by Bob Dylan. It's called "Most of the Time," and it's clearly a kind of a lament that he wrote after someone broke up with him. His, I don't know, divorce or a woman left him, but it's much broader application than just a romantic relationship. I'll read just the first three stanzas. Most of the time, I'm clear, focused all around. Most of the time, I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path. I can read the sign. Stay right with it when the road unwinds. I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice she's gone most of the time. Most of the time it's well understood. Most of the time I wouldn't change it if I could. I can make it all match up. I can hold my own. I can deal with a situation right down to the bone. I can survive and I can endure, and I don't even think about her most of the time. Most of the time my head is on straight. Most of the time I'm strong enough not to hate. I don't build up illusion till it makes me sick. I ain't afraid of confusion, no matter how thick. I can smile in the face of mankind. Don't even remember what her lips felt like on mine most of the time. Is another koan, very famous one. I was part of a teleconference on koans a couple weeks ago that was that will appear in Buddha Dharma magazine. And near the end of the conference, the interviewer asked each of us, the three of us, to name a favorite koan. And this one was the one I came up with. It's so hard, it's a ridiculous name, but name a favorite koan. But this is one of my favorites for sure, because of its depth and profundity and complexity. It's quite short. I'll just do it from memory. A master said, it's like a buffalo passing through a window. Its head, horns, and four legs all pass through. Why doesn't its tail, too? The tail. Most of the time. And this tale, this most of the time idea, offers the wonderful motivation to continue practice after awakening. In another koan of the Mumonkan, the Blue Cliff Record, number 46, Kyosei, Sound of the Raindrops. the master takes issue with something the monk says. It's raining out, and he asks the monk, "What's the noise out there?" Of course, he knows what the noise is out there. He's testing him. "What's the noise out there?" The monk said, "The sound of raindrops." Kyosei said, "Men's thinking is inverted. Deluded by their own selves, they pursue things." The monk asked, "What about you, teacher?" Kyosei said, "I am almost but not quite deluded." it's so much, it's a matter of the base that we're working from. Roshi Kapila also talked about a first awakening experience, Kensho, as changing the base from one of self-centeredness to one as seeing, having seen through the self, no self. He would use this wonderful analogy of the sun rising. So it, in the depths of the night, let's say at midnight, everything is dark. This, in terms of this analogy, means delusion. And then with the approach of dawn, then you starts to get faintly lighter. This would be a more advanced practice after a more experienced practitioner. And it gets lighter and lighter, the ambient light. Still the sun is below the horizon, but it's getting lighter. It's dawn. And then there's that moment where the sun, the upper edge of the sun, just peeps up over the horizon. That, you could say, is a first awakening experience, what the Chinese sometimes call entering the first gate. Now, it's still pretty dim light with just that first little sliver of the sun peeping up over the horizon. But now you could say that this is a tipping point. This is the turning point. Still have a lot further to go until it's high noon, broad daylight, but at least now the terms have changed. With an attachment to purity or perfection, we always run the risk of turning against ourselves. You see this in eating disorders. You see it in fitness disorders, what I'll call fitness disorders. And I found this article about how this attachment to purity and perfection is playing out these days in terms of fitness. It's I'm afraid I just have the one sheet, so I'm not sure what I don't even know how I got it, but it's the only thing I see is the word first in bold print at the top. First, October 19th, 2014. And it's by a Heather Havrileski. She's a columnist for New York Magazine. Maybe it's New York Magazine at all. Anyway, I'll start off with a kind of a vivid description here. Oh, the subtitle is America's Fascination with Extreme Fitness. A blonde woman in a hot pink spandex tank hoists a sledgehammer over her shoulders, then slams it down with a dull thud onto the big tire in front of her. Beside her, another woman swings her sledgehammer even higher, grimacing and groaning with the effort. Their faces are bright red and dripping with sweat. It's 9:45 a.m. and 85 degrees, and the sun is glinting off the asphalt of the strip mall parking lot where the women are laboring. "Swing it higher, above your shoulder," a woman bellows at them, even as they gasp each time they raise their hammers, each time they let them fall. As one woman pauses to wipe the sweat from her eyes, she spots me studying her. I've been trying not to stare, but it's a strange spectacle, this John Henry workout of theirs, hammering away in front of a woman's fitness center, just a few doors down from a smoke shop and a hair salon. It looks exhausting, and more than a little dangerous. It also looks fruitless. Why not join a roofing crew for a few hours instead? Or you could say, in this neck of the country, shovel some snow. surely there's a tunnel somewhere that needs digging, or at least some hot tar that needs pouring. But paying to simulate backbreaking labor under the watchful eye of a demanding authority figure seems to be a common desire these days. When I type sledgehammer into Google later that day, the first suggestion is sledgehammer workout, a search term that pours forth half a dozen enthusiastic reenactments of life on a steel-driving chain gang. I'm skipping some paragraphs here. She talks about this this program called CrossFit that has seized the country as far as extreme fitness, and she quotes a spokesperson for CrossFit: "We have sought to build a program that will best prepare trainees for any physical contingency, not only for the unknown but for the unknowable." And then the author says, "This dark talk passes for welcoming language on the website of CrossFit, the intense, ultra-competitive conditioning program whose motto, Forging Elite Fitness, reflects our current fascination with both elite athletes and elite military forces." Maybe this is behind the popularity of American Sniper, the movie. "In spite of, or because of, the fact that CrossFit is now nearly synonymous with overexertion, there are more than 6,000 affiliates in the United States. Those stunned by CrossFit's growing popularity are often surprised, given its high price, to discover its Spartan ethos. Each box," that's its lingo for a gym, "each box is often just a big empty room with medicine balls, barbells, and wooden boxes stacked along the walls. Workouts rotate daily but tend to involve free weights, sprints, and enough squats to cripple Charles Atlas. In keeping with its apocalyptic mission statement, the program encourages camaraderie under duress. CrossFitters coach each other through the pain. And competition. Names and scores are scrawled on a whiteboard and sometimes posted online." So here too, this exquisite fusion of small s self and capital S self, the aspirational aspect to it, aspiring to go beyond oneself, to develop oneself, and then contaminated by what is obviously the ego. "Despite the inherent risks of hundreds of thousands of people dabbling in Olympic weightlifting techniques at their local strip malls, CrossFitters seem utterly dedicated to their hardcore workouts. CrossFit's founder, Greg Glassman, admitted in 2005 that rhabdomyolysis, a dangerous condition that can lead to kidney failure, had popped up among a few new CrossFit converts. He viewed it, in part, as evidence of CrossFit's, quote, dominance over traditional training protocols." There's the word that gives away the ego, dominance. "This type of conditioning was important not just for body tone, but also for responding to future calamity." And then he talks more about that. "CrossFitters represent just one wave of a fitness sea change in which well-to-do Americans abandon easy, convenient forms of exercise in favor of workouts grueling enough to resemble a kind of physical atonement." Now here's where we get into the religious aspect of this, the attachment to purity and perfection. "For the most privileged among us, freedom seems to feel oppressive, and oppression feels like freedom. There's also a very American fixation on extremes at play. More is always better. If you're running just 4 miles a day and doing a few pull-ups, you're a wimp compared with the buff dude who's ready for an appearance on American Ninja Warrior. It's hard not to feel awe when you watch a middle-aged woman in a never-quit t-shirt clean and jerk huge weights. And it's hardly a stretch to go from lifting a 35-pound kettlebell to wondering why you can't run half a mile with it, especially when a CrossFit coach is right there urging you to crush it. Common wisdom seems to dictate that it's not enough to look good and feel good if you're not prepared to lift a Mini Cooper off an injured stranger. The whole notion of pushing your physical limits, popularized by early Nike ads, Navy SEAL mythos, and Lance Armstrong's cult of personality, so the whole notion of pushing your physical limits has attained a religiosity that's as passionate as it is pervasive. The extreme version of anything is now widely assumed to be an improvement on the original rather than a perverse amplification of it. And as with most of sports culture, there's no gray area. You win or you lose. You leave it all on the floor or you shamefully skulk off the floor with extra gas in your tank. But our new religion has more than a little in common with the religions that brought our ancestors to America in the first place. Like the idealists and extremists who founded this country, that's the word, Puritans, the modern zealots of exercise turn their backs on the indulgences of our culture, seeking solace in self-abnegation and suffering. Here again, the middle way, this as contrasted with the middle way between self-punishment and self-indulgence. This is the route to a better life, they tell us, gesturing at their sledgehammers and their kettlebells, their military drills and their dramatic reenactments of hard labor. And in these uncertain times, it doesn't sound so bad to be prepared for some coming disaster, or even for an actual job doing hard labor if our empire ever falls. One last paragraph. It makes sense that for those segments of humanity who aren't fighting for survival every day of their lives, the new definition of fulfillment is feeling as if you're about to die. Maybe that's the point. If we weren't lugging 5 gallons of water back from a well 10 miles away or slamming a hammer into a mountainside, something feels as if it's missing. Who wants to sit alone at a desk all day, then work out alone on a machine? Why can't we suffer and sweat together as a group in a way that feels meaningful? She's getting at this deeper longing that we have to join others. Why can't someone yell at us while we do it? Not so much. For the privileged, maybe the most grueling path seems the most likely to lead to divinity. When I run on Sunday mornings, I pass 7 packed, bustling fitness boutiques and 5 nearly empty churches. I think she really gets at this longing for self-transcendence in the best sense, and yet it has these unhealthy elements to it. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.